I'm Brian McCreath at Symphony Hall with Håkan Hardenberger, who's back with the BSO for H.K. Gruber's Ariel. Håkan, thanks for a little bit of your time today. I appreciate it.
Oh, great pleasure. Thank you.
So this piece is almost 20 years old now, and yet for this audience, this is going to kind of be a new experience. So let's just talk about it like it's a new piece, and if you will. When you asked H.K. Gruber to write this, first of all, what led you to him to write a new concerto, and how involved did you get with the composition process?
Oh, well, I knew H.K. Gruber a long time. There's a piece called Frankenstein that, of course, we all know. And I remember being in Vienna playing the Zimmermann, and someone pointed out that that's H.K. Gruber there playing the double bass, and he was sitting there sort of half sleeping behind his bass. He always said that the bass is the best instrument for a composer who composes at night because he can sleep behind the bass all through rehearsal. And then I walked up to him and I said, you know, would he fancy writing for the trumpet? And in a very Viennese way, he said, yes, of course, yes, one day, you know, bye-bye. And it, of course, it meant, you know, kind of no, go away. And then, however, I was back there some years later. He was still playing in the orchestra. And by then, I had a promise from the BBC for a commission. And he was high on my list. By then I heard more of his music. There's a beautiful second violin concerto called Nebelstein Musik, which is, I must say, I mean, the slow movement in that is one of the most beautiful movements of 20th century music that I know. So I asked him again, and he was also on the list of BBC, so it turned out very well, and he ended up writing Ariel then in 99.
Right, almost 20 years ago now.
Yes, yeah. And it's been, of course, one of the greater success pieces I've had. I've played it over 80 times, and with New York Philharmonic, Chicago, Berlin Philharmonic, all over the world, and it's a being. This piece, you know, it's an animal or an emotional journey. You know, the first movement very much an emotional journey. It's got a couple of quotations that give good hints to what it is. I mean, done with a compass, done with a chart, from Emily Dickinson, and it was actually even about his composition technique. He's someone who works a lot with schemes and mathematical charts, and he simply didn't have time. He wrote the first movement last, and he was out of time, and he threw away everything and just went with emotion. And it's amazing how he sets these kind of clockworks ticking in the first movement, and they still end up in a sort of golden schnitt at the end of the movement. Apparently, I mean, it must be that he was so used to these charts that they were then almost in him, and for me, he takes away basically most of my possibilities. And there's another quotation, very beautiful, by Heine, about trying to express your innermost feeling with a broken voice, and this is. The first movement starts, of course, with a sort of, I imagine this as the first music almost. You know, you have this icy landscape, and there's almost no, it's cold, and there's almost no life, and I have to sing and play this.
The multiphonics.
Yes. That was another story. He asked me if it could be done on the trumpet, and I said no, of course.
Oh, I was going to ask you if this was something, because I've known people to just kind of goof around and try that, but this is he wrote this in with specific pitches in mind, and you had to learn how to do it.
Well, we were in this hotel room, and he asked me if it could be done on the trumpet, and I said no. I tried a lot, and on the trombone and the horn, because of less resistance, it works, but on the trumpet, no. And you always have to sing higher than you play for it to work. So, and then he said, show me it doesn't work. And then he said, play the lowest note in your instrument, then sing not one fifth higher or a fourth higher, but one, so in falsetto, an octave and that's what I did. And there we were, there was a perfect chord of three notes. You know, you have the one you play, the one you sing, and then the resultant.
The resultant tone, the sound waves kind of combining exactly. And creating that third
so
pitch.
So that he picks up very cleverly in the harmonization of the piece. And so that's how it starts. And then in the next little section, I slide around the notes. They're not fixed, they're all in glissando. And then I actually start pulling the trumpet apart. First, the first slide, and you get these echo sounds. Very hard to play them in tune, and he said, well, just try to play them as much in tune as you can. That's going to be the beauty of the broken voice.
Because for someone who doesn't, so when you take a slide out, you're kind of redirecting the vibration through the horn, and that first vowel slide becomes, in effect, the bell of the trumpet at that point.
Yes, and the note has no possibility. You have to fix it with your own ear and the lip, because it's not fixed by the instrument.
Yeah.
And you get these beautiful echo sounds that he again picks up in the orchestration very beautifully. And the next step, then, that sound world sort of prepares for the next step. And he asked me, what is the first Swedish trumpet? I think not for the sake of it being Swedish, but so I said, the cowhorn. And he said, do you have one? And I said, no, but I can get one. That cow happened to be in B flat, so this this horn plays a little modal fifth in B flat.
Did you put holes in it or anything? Or?
It has holes. That's a traditional Swedish folklore instrument like that.
Got it.
And played up in the mountains, mostly by the ladies who were keeping the, you know, centuries ago, ladies alone and keeping the cattle and communicating with this. But of course he doesn't write the folklore music at all. He writes this sort of timeless tune, could be Miles on a Cloud or something like, and he writes completely chromatically for this and for me to figure out then, you know, with different stopping so again, you know, almost taking away my possibilities.
So that's the second time you said that. Just say a little bit more about what that means. What do you mean by taking away your possibilities?
Well, it's the broken voice. You know, there's no point in, I think, you know, the tradition of the solo concerto being this heroic display. I mean, that's very non-poetic. And I think when we try to express our innermost feelings, the voice is very often broken, and we don't find the words, do we? You know. So then I go over the piccolo trumpet that moves too fast and too high. And then finally, at the end, I have a complete trumpet and I get to express. And we are harmonically, we're all almost, he says, I'm still in Mahler or Schoenberg. I mean, it's you know, the way the chords resolve, and it's the expression is absolutely Mahlerian. ending of the piece, and you, and it's highly emotional, but only to be cut off at the very point, and then this, you still have this fifth remaining then in the strings that is the beginning of the piece. And then we have the second movement, which has the title Gone Dancing. And that was actually my idea, the title, because the movement was finished and we were, and it has this, someone described it as a ballroom hallucination. You have these Fred Astaire, Ginger Rogers rhythms, and you have Charleston, and you have Romanian folklore, and it's all in a sort of cloud, and it ends in a not good way, I think, the climax of this. So we imagine this whole little scene of an old man and a boy sitting on another planet, looking down at Earth, and Earth is empty, and we don't quite know why, but it's empty. And there's just a sign, and it says, "Gone dancing." Not gone fishing, but gone dancing. so it's tragedy, but it's paradox. Typical Viennese double meaning.
Almost, I mean, in a way, it's sort of like La Valse that way. It's like a dance gone crazy.
Exactly, and you know. You have all these jazz rhythms, you know, almost West Side Story-like, and you almost expect this, and there's a break, you know, when we it starts. And you almost expect in that break the orchestra to go. So you have this double entendre that it has all this lively and kind of lighthearted music, but it's all, you can also hear sometimes there's like a march rhythm persisting underneath. And then it does crash, doesn't it?
Yeah, right.
There's this totally wild upheaval of all these rhythms. And it crashes and remains the 12-8 rhythm a la Bernstein, but you can hear that it's kind of broken, and then I walk away on the last note, and I make the piano throw that note back into space.
And from a technical point of view, what that means is the pianist is holding down some keys and you blast a note into the piano. Yes. That resonates then. So the pianist didn't actually do anything other than hold those keys down and open the strings, and the resonance carries away, as you say, into outer space.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
It's fantastic.
It's
great.
A highly imaginative piece. And I mean, I did give him sort of all the tricks because I knew he would do something poetic with it.
Yeah.
And it's a sort of music you can enter it on any level you want. You know, it's not program music. I mean, as such, and you can enter it at whatever level you like. But those are some of mine.
Fantastic. It's a great guided tour of Ariel. That's fantastic. Wow, we got a lot to work with there. Just that on a broader scale, you've expanded the repertoire by getting composers to write stuff for you, and was the motivation behind that more in the area of there just weren't a lot of trumpet concertos, or was it more, I just really like new music, I like what composers are doing, and I want to do some of that?
Well, it was a bit of everything. It was also, I realized that I liked playing as a soloist. I would be more nervous when I sat in the orchestra waiting and to play that perfect solo, and I enjoyed, and I noticed that people were listening when I was playing. And then the idea of traveling around and leaving your family at home to go out and play Haydn on a few pieces in D major, I don't think that would have lasted so long. you know, it's too hard to do. So I needed stories to tell, I think, and still am constantly on the search of a masterpiece. I mean, the thought that Ariel is now 20 years old almost is almost bewildering. And as you said, for some people it will still feel modern, but everything was at some point modern. So was Beethoven. And I think it's funny because I think music takes longer. I think modern art, as in painting or modern art, is quicker. Even modern dance is quicker. It's only now, for instance, that the concerto by Bernd Alois Zimmermann that I've played a lot this year since he would have been 100 years old. It's only now that this piece that was written in 1954, it's only now that that's becoming proper repertoire and that people don't find it that strange. But for some people, some audience, even Sibelius or certainly Stravinsky and Bartok will feel like modern music, or even if it's over 100 years old. So it's, everything is relative, as a famous person once said.
Does anybody even ask you to play the Haydn anymore?
Oh yeah, and I want to. I mean, Haydn is great music, and it's
oh no doubt, yeah. No,
and what I try to avoid is to play it with people who won't take it serious enough. So it's, and you know, maybe not too many times in a year, but sometimes also it will be very good to have Haydn in there to show that it's the same. They were after the, Haydn was modern. He was very extremely modern.
Well, yeah, that piece especially was like something nobody had ever heard a trumpet do that stuff before.
And he was full of surprises, and like every composer I have ever worked with, however dogmatic they are in their notation or how complicated, they are always wanting the spontaneous communication. This is always, even in the most cerebral work, it's always the case.
Håkan Hardenberger, thanks a lot for your time today. Thanks for being here. Looking forward to Ariel.
Thank you very much. Pleasure.